Chapter 14. The ice was 20 kilometers thick. 20,000 seconds of travel once Nissa's ship had reached a vertical descent angle. From the first moment of immersion, the melted ice screening windows and cameras, there was nothing to see except the graphs and numbers of cockpit displays tracking their progress. For the most part, they were heading straight down. But now and then, Nissa steered them around some rocky or metallic thing entombed in the ice, preferring caution to bravado.
"There are whole ships down here," she said, with a sort of reverent awe in her voice. "They crash-landed, began to melt into the ice whether they wanted to or not. They'll still be here when the sun swallows Mars."
After a while, Nissa felt she could rely on the automatic pilot. She had not slept since their arrival at Jupiter, and wanted to be as alert as possible once they were through the ice.
"We'll pop out in another 2 hours unless the radar picks up something we need to steer around. You should grab some rest, too. We'll be busy little beavers once we break through, and our 48 hours will be over before you know it."
It was sleep, she meant, rather than 2 hours of lovemaking. Agreeing with the eminent good sense of this proposal, Kanu retreated to his cabin. He doubted he would be able to sleep for the entire 2 hours, but decided to make the best of what was on offer. Everything was flipped now. Up and down, reversed compared to deep space. And the noise of the heating and traction devices was louder and less regular than the in-flight systems. But he would adapt to one set of circumstances as readily as another. "It's time." The voice was clear, quiet, and quite unmistakably his own. Kanu froze. Every doubt, every bad thought confirmed in that one impossible utterance. He was alone in his chamber, Nissa doubtless already asleep in hers. There was no immediate sense of another presence in the room, but he knew how the voice of his own thought processes sounded, and this was different. An acoustic and spatial shift. The auditory information reaching his brain along the usual sensory and neural channels, as if it had been whispered into his ear. "I said, it's time." He whispered back, "I heard you." "You don't have to speak aloud. That would get awkward very quickly. Simply think your responses clearly." The voice paused, almost as if giving him a moment to adjust to its presence. "How much do you understand or remember?"
"I remember Mars. I remember nearly dying on Mars. This is about that, isn't it?"
"Of course."
"You've done something to me. I've been feeling as much for days. You've put something in me, changed me in some way. My meeting Nissa. That was never a coincidence, was it?"
"If you are a puppet, Kanu, then you should know your puppeteer. Will you do me a small favor?"
"Do you a favor?"
"All right, for both of us then. Move to your private wash basin and run the hot water until the mirror steams up. Can you do that for me?" Of course he could. If it meant getting an answer, or even just the beginning of an answer, he would oblige. He allowed the mirror to begin to mist, greying out his reflection. "Now, neatly and precisely, draw an equilateral triangle in the steam, flat side down. Position yourself exactly in front of the triangle, and look at nothing else."
"Why?"
"It's a visual mnemonic trigger. Your memories will unlock in their own good time, but this will accelerate the process. Do it, Kanu. What do you have to lose?" He recognized the room instantly. It was where Swift had first allowed him sight, and where he had first learned of the deaths of Dalal and Lucian. He recalled sitting in a chair, and a view of the robot city beyond the window. Now he was in the chair again. This time there was a difference, though. He was looking at himself, seeing his body from the outside. Seeing himself, he realized again, from Swift's point of view, as he had during the dream of the operating theater.
"This is complicated."
The version of him seated in the chair was addressing the version
haunting his own memory. Very complicated and very delicate, but we need to get the essential facts straight before we go any further. Something bad happened to you on Mars. Call it a terrorist incident, call it a stupid accident. Either way, the machines did not engineer it, but there are never truly any accidents, just unforeseen opportunities. Who am I? The seated counterpart of himself raised a silencing hand. I'm you. I'm you before some of your memories are, or were, deliberately blocked from conscious recall. That's so you can leave Mars and pass our colleague's scrutiny before safely returning to Earth. It's your choice. My choice. Our choice. Kanu had 100 questions, but he allowed the speaker to continue. After your accident, but before your return to the embassy, Swift confided something in you. Swift revealed to you knowledge obtained by the Evolvarium, knowledge of a potentially destabilizing nature. Shall I remind you of what Swift told you, Kanu? Briefly, then, the machines have intercepted a signal from deep interstellar space. No one here knows about it yet, because it was never aimed at our solar system. The signal was directed at Crucible, around 61 Virginis. Its point of origin, as near as can be determined, is another solar system, about 70 light years from Crucible. That system is Gliese 163. It has never been of interest to you, the machines, or anyone else. No human expedition has gone anywhere near it, and yet someone there has sent a message, and the message was aimed at Crucible, and the message appears to be urgent. The speaker allowed itself a silence before proceeding. You may wonder how this information reached the Evolvarium. Isn't the Evolvarium supposed to be quarantined on Mars, denied access to the rest of the universe? All of that is correct, but it underestimates the ingenuity of the likes of Swift. The machines have never established a physical presence beyond Mars, but their capability for obtaining information, it is vastly superior to even the best estimates of the consolidation. When they put you back together, Kanu, the machines made some deliberate mistakes, simply so that their work would not look too perfect. The figure laughed, stiffening his back in the seat. I mean no disrespect. I couldn't very well disrespect myself, could I? The point, anyway, is that the machines are able to tap into a very extended informational network with peripheral branches extending all the way to Crucible. And they picked up on the existence of this transmission before it reached the intelligence networks of any of the major powers in this solar system, including our beloved Merfolk, Kanu. There are limits even to their omniscience. Kanu could not begin to see where this was headed. The mere existence of this message would be surprising enough, his shadow self continued, especially as the message is framed in human terms for human comprehension, because there should not be anyone out there to send a message in the first place. But there's a deeper mystery here, and a direct reason why the message is of specific interest to our friends on Mars. They think another machine may have sent it, and the likely identity of this artificial intelligence should be of specific interest to you as well, since there's a strong family connection. Do I need to spell it out?
Eunice, Kanu breathed. He remembered the exhibition in Lisbon, the construct simulation of his great-great-great-grandmother, enthroned in glass, except what he had seen was a copy of a copy, not the construct itself. According to the annotation, nobody was certain what had become of the real thing.
If you believe the rumors,
the speaker went on,
the actual construct, the illegal, unlicensed Artilect emulation of Eunice Akinia, hid aboard one of the holoships and travelled to Crucible. Then, shortly after the settlement, it disappeared again. The rumors, as before, make of them what you will, say that it was abducted by the Watchkeepers, spirited away into interstellar space, or taken as part of some agreement in exchange for the settlement and exploration of Crucible. Either way, there is a direct connection to the aliens. And now, something pops up around Gliese 163, but instead of announcing itself to the universe, it chooses to communicate only with Crucible.
The figure shifted in the chair.
I don't know about you, but I put some stock in those rumors. Our other mother, one of our other mothers anyway, was also involved in that supposed business with the Watchkeepers. They took Chico Green with them, too. Surely that holds some significance for you. Anyway, the Evolverium has declared an interest. The collective consciousness of the machines must now confront the possibility that there may be another artificial intelligence out there, an Artilect old enough to predate the fall of the mechanism. Furthermore, it's woven around the personality of the woman who might have single-handedly initiated the Evolverium. Machines don't believe in God's Kanu, but if they did, she'd be a good candidate. Naturally, they'd like to know what's happening around Gliese 163. That's where we come in.
We?
Your injuries were definitely the unfortunate result of terrorist activities, but the incident also provided an opportunity. You are still who you were, but you now serve two masters. When the machines remade your nervous system, they encoded a tiny part of themselves into you. Not via implants, that would have been much too crude and easy to detect, but via the actual topological map of your idiosyncratic connectome. There has always been great redundancy in the human brain, Kanu. Now some of that redundancy has been co-opted, given over to the Evolverium. You are carrying part of it inside you, influencing your actions and intentions. Influencing, not determining. You still have free will, but the epicenter of your sympathies has shifted. You have not turned traitor to the human species, but from now on, the interests of the machines will be of equal importance to you. You stand between two worlds, Kanu.
Kanu felt an immediate and visceral revulsion, but also a kind of relief that he now had an explanation for his sense of dislocation. He was neither mad nor traumatized, or no more than might be expected given his ordeal. But what had been done to him was still profoundly wrong.
Here's the important thing, the speaker said. This state of affairs was not forced upon you. It was arrived at by mutual agreement. During the early stages of your recuperation, long before you remember coming back to consciousness, Swift explained to you the nature of the crisis, how the message relates to the machines and the Watchkeepers and our ancestor, how they are anxious to know more, anxious to respond, but cannot share this information with the conservative, machine-phobic governments of the solar system. Swift suggested a solution. Use you as the means for the machines to extend their influence beyond Mars. You become their vehicle and their agency, Kanu. Both of you understood that it would be the end of your diplomatic career, but that was actually a blessing, as it would hasten your return to Earth and make it possible for you to set in motion the second part of the plan. Europa is the key. Europa has always been the key. You only had to find a way to get here, a way to get under the ice. But you had already solved that particular problem on Mars. You just needed to reconnect with Nissa Mbaye, to whom you'd once been married.
They broke through the crust on schedule. He was sitting with Nissa on the command deck, waiting as the radar began to detect the imminent transition from ice to water.
"Suitably refreshed?" Nissa asked.
For an instant, Kanu hesitated, on the verge of confession. It would feel good to unburden himself, to submit to her understanding and forgiveness. But if his newly uncovered memories were correct, he had come here for a reason. If his confession forced Nissa to turn back, he would have learned nothing about himself, nothing about the grander objectives of the machines. He had to keep the truth hidden for a little longer.
As a matter of fact, he answered, despising himself, I've never felt better.
Good, because the clock's been ticking since we landed. I'm testing the law, but I don't want to break it, especially with that heavy consolidation presence in orbit. To be back on the surface within the agreed window, we'll need to allow enough time to chew through the ice again.
He was working the controls, preparing for the shift from tunneling machine to submarine.
We'll be going fast and deep. We'll need to cover a few hundred kilometers to reach our objective.
She looked at him with sudden eagerness.
What's the deepest you've ever gone on Earth? 10 kilometers, maybe?
Only as a passenger. A lot less under my own power.
We're going down much further than that. More than 100 kilometers of vertical descent. I know that sounds impossible, but this is Europa, not Earth, and the pressure builds much more slowly. We'll top out at about 200 megapascals, easily within the hull's crush tolerance.
I sincerely hope so,
Kanu said, not for one moment doubting her words. She flashed back a quick smile.
Well, if I'm wrong, it'll be quick.
Not a stray photon of starlight made it down through the 20 kilometers of icy crust. Fall of Night was swimming now, its motion smoother than when it had been tunneling. Their angle of descent was shallower, and the only sound beyond the ordinary life support systems was the whir of water thrusters. They could have been in the most perfect starless vacuum, adrift between the galaxies.
Nissa, he said, there's something I need.
Can't you turn off your anxieties, Maman, just for a few hours?
I don't think so, no.
And there was the first flash of real irritation.
What's troubling you now?
More than we have time to cover at the moment. This objective of yours, can you tell me a little more about it? I understand you wanting to keep things as close to your chest as possible until we got here, but we're on Europa now. Shouldn't I know the full picture?
Nissa gave a small sigh and called up a map of the European surface, peeled open like an orange.
We are here, she said, jabbing with a finger. All these dots, these are abandoned cities. Abandoned doesn't mean empty, of course.
Her finger skated to a knot of ruins, settling on one bloated dot.
This is Andathrace. It was one of the biggest subsurface settlements before the fall, a bubble economy, skirting the brink of what was legal or ethical elsewhere in the system. You can see why it would have appealed to your grandmother.
You have proof that Sunday was here?
Concrete. I've seen the paper trails. When your family's finances were on the slide, it looked like they tried to move a lot of their more questionable holdings into Underthrace's independent credit system. My guess is Sunday was shrewd enough to want to safeguard her art as well.
Kanu nodded slowly.
I'm sure you're right. It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if she banked some of her artworks here. If nothing else, she wouldn't have wanted the market flooded with her work after her death.
I'm glad you approve of my theory. It would be a little disappointing to be wrong.
I don't think you are. But I suspect there might be something else in Underthrace.
Nissa twisted to face him again.
Something to do with Sunday?
I doubt she would have had direct knowledge of it. It's more likely to have been initiated by the next generation. My mother, her contemporaries, they'd have had the time and the knowledge.
The time and the knowledge for what?
Nissa, it's time I spoke frankly. This isn't what you think it is. There's something much bigger going on. You've come to Europa on some pretexts, but so have I. Our meeting wasn't coincidence after all.
What do you mean?
I always knew you'd be in Lisbon, and that there was a good chance we'd run into each other.
No, she said flatly. I was there. I saw your reaction. You were as surprised as I was.
At the time, I believed it was a genuine coincidence.
They had descended 20 kilometers since breaking through the ice, deeper than any part of Earth's seas, and mindless black fathoms lay beneath them still. From the hull there came not a murmur of complaint, as it bore the smoothly rising stresses.
"Only yesterday," Nyssa said, "you told me you didn't feel quite right. I reassured you it was to be expected and dismissed your concerns. But it's obvious now that I was wrong, for which I apologize. I should have listened to you. But we're on Europa because I chose to come here, looking for art, not because of some grand conspiracy you dragged me into. Can you hold on to that simple truth for a few hours?"
Kanu closed his eyes, opened them again, hoping that the world would have done the decent thing and changed into a less problematic version of itself.
"I want to."
"So do me a favor and try. There are some floating structures coming up soon, which will cut through to save time. We may stir up a few wriggles as we pass, and I don't want to be distracted if that happens."
Then added under her breath,
"The 4 days home are going to be interesting."
There was no point in stealth. Fall of night searchlights pushed out at all angles into the surrounding water, turning the little ship into a neon-spined pufferfish. Nyssa did not care who knew of her arrival, only that she did not startle the unwary. They nosed through looming dark structures, still secured to the ocean floor, ovals or spheres for the most part, strung along the tethers like baubles. Each of the ruins was large enough to be considered a city in its own right, and indeed, according to the maps and records, many of them had been autonomous enclaves, bubbles within the bubble, exploring their own fringes of the edge economy. Nyssa was justifiably nervous. There were hot spots and pressure gradients, evidence of recent or ongoing inhabitation. Kanu felt the tension boiling off her.
"They talk about the Ricos as if they're one thing," she said,
keeping up a commentary as if it was the only thing holding them both on the right side of sanity.
"In truth, there are about 100 different factions down here, and most of them hate each other more than they hate us."
"Who is your contact? What are you hoping to exchange for the artworks?"
"My contact is the Margrave. As for leverage, man is useless down here. There are no economic ties to the rest of the system, no way of moving credit in or out."
But then she noticed something.
"Oh, what's this?"
"Show me."
"Movement. Warm objects."
She tapped her finger against a smudge of thermal signatures emerging from a fissure in one of the tethered structures. The thermal signatures were wriggles, but moving too swiftly to be swimming under their own power. There were a dozen of them, organized into an arrowhead squadron. Fall of night sensors picked up the powered drones they were using for propulsion, each wriggle drawn along by one of the machines. They could swim, of course. All of the wriggles had tails and flippers rather than legs, but machines would always be faster. They were armed and armored, but it all looked makeshift, cobbled together from technological junk and detritus, the scavenged titbits of what had once been a thriving submarine economy.
"The Margrave's people?"
"Probably. We are in his sphere of jurisdiction, more or less."
"You don't sound certain."
"I was told I wouldn't be contacted until we reached Underthrace itself."
"Could we outrun them?"
"Oh, easily. Wouldn't gain us much, though. If you don't do business with the Regals, you don't do business with anyone."
The Regals carried their own lights. They had glow sticks and luminous paint, some of which flickered and changed in a way that reminded Kanu of Sunday's psycho-reactive graffiti. Their submarine armor was horned and bladed. They also carried long, spear-like weapons with triggers and gas canisters. Nyssa allowed them to approach. She did not increase fall of night speed or take evasive action. Equally, she did not deviate from their original course. The Regals split their formation and surrounded Nyssa's ship. They had no difficulty matching pace. Kanu heard clangs and thumps as they knocked carelessly against the hull, followed by the long fingernail scrape of a spear or harpoon being drawn down the length of the ship.
"It's intimidation," Nyssa said. "That's all."
A Regal suddenly stationed itself in front of the command deck window, grappling on with plate-sized suction clamps. Kano had a much better view of its armor and equipment now. It was a very muscular creature, with a powerful tail and torso, strong-looking arms, wide webbed hands and barely any neck. It was hard to see its face behind the partial mask covering its nose and mouth, which he guessed was either a breathing apparatus or part of some water intake and oxygenation system. Its eyes were hidden by strap-on goggles, pushed into the dough of its face like two black eggs. Its visible skin, where the armor did not cover it, was an off-white or pale green. The Regal unclipped something from its utility belt that looked like a smaller version of the suction clamps, which it pushed against the glass before fiddling two tubes into holes on either side of its skull. Then it took another item from the belt, a metal cone, and jammed the open end of it hard against the glass. Kanu flinched as the Regal bent its face to the narrow end of the cone. Indistinct watery sounds came through the glass. It was language, possibly even one of the common tongues, but mangled beyond recognition by cultural isolation and the forbidding physics of this environment. Kanu thought he could make out a word or two. It might have been Swahili. Identify. Ocean. Exclusion. Anger. But it was very difficult to be sure. He began to open his mouth, but Nissa raised a cautioning hand.
They can hear us now, through that stethoscope, she said in a low voice.
Then, projecting her voice with theatrical clarity,
I am Nissa Mbaye. I have come to Europa on peaceful business under a consolidation permit. The Margrave of Andastres is expecting me. May I have safe passage?
An answer came back. To Kanu's ears it was no more comprehensible than the first, but Nissa must have prepared herself for dialogue with the Regals. Speaking for Kanu's ears only, she said,
They say the Margrave won't speak to me, so I'm wasting my time.
That's a good start.
They also say they're happy for me to waste my time, provided I pay a tribute or a toll for passing through this part of the ocean.
Were you expecting to pay a toll?
I anticipated the demand.
Nissa shifted her voice into her louder register.
I am honored to offer tribute. I am opening my dorsal cargo hatch. Please, take what you will, with my respect and gratitude.
She made the hatch spring open. Kanu watched her silently, impressed by her preparedness. The Regal detached its stethoscope and unsuckered itself, then swam around the ship to join its fellows by the cargo hatch. The knocking and scraping had intensified around that area.
What did you bring? Kanu asked.
Medicines, vitamins and food supplements.
But in her voice he heard trepidation. It was all very well speculating on what the Regals would consider an acceptable tribute. It was quite a different matter to put that idea to the test. Angry thumps and knocks sounded along the hull.
Could they damage us?
Jam the thrusters and steering gear, maybe. Block the water cooling intake. Not much else.
That already sounds bad enough.
Nissa's expression tightened. The main Regal had returned to the window, holding a fistful of small white pills, which were already beginning to dissolve into the water. The Regal mashed the soggy pills and hammered the pulped remains against the glass. It barked some oath into the water, the sound strong enough to reach Kanu even without the speaking cone. Then it gave a jerk of its tail and flicked away into the water. The hammering and scraping abated. One or two strikes more, a dismissive final clang, and they were free of the Regals.
Did we pass or fail?
If we'd failed, we'd know it, Nissa said. That was just their way of letting me know they were being generous, that my offering was at the lower threshold of what they consider acceptable.
She touched a control, and the window glass cleaned itself. The Regals had departed. They were alone again, still moving ever deeper into the ocean. Kanu did not allow himself to relax. There was too much on his mind for that. But they had cleared one hurdle, and Nissa's ingenuity led him to hope they would be capable of clearing more if they arose. If all else failed, he supposed,
They always had the option of drilling their way back out of Europa. The Regals would not be so foolish as to try to hold them hostage, would they? But they could only have travelled another few kilometres closer to Underthrace when their lights picked out a familiar masked and goggled face rising in the waters before them, as if to block their passage.
No, Nyssa said with anger this time. We did a deal. We had an arrangement.
But her concerns were misplaced. It was the same Regal, certainly. But there was no actual body accompanying its face. The Regal's head had been cut off and skewered on a pike. Holding the pike, hovering before them, was another humanoid aquatic creature. It carried no lights, and its mostly black armour was both more functional and less ostentatious than that of the earlier Regals. It looked to Carnu's eyes no less dangerous or forbidding. But the creature waved its arm, indicating that they should follow it. With one flick of its tail it was underway, the Regal's skewered head still in its grasp.
Finally, Nyssa said, someone with manners.